And let us now move to the second speaker of this session, Konstantin Jordaki, professor at the Department of History of the Central European University in Budapest. He is a co-editor of the journal East Central Europe and president of the International Association for Comparative Fascist Studies and a member of the Academic Committee of the House of the European History in Brussels, as a historian specializing in the problem of fascism in Europe. And one of the most recent publication concerns the fascist Romanian period of the 1927 and 1941. So the paper will be about enacting the communist utopia, the 1950s, inside the 20th century.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this introduction, Jerome. And Jerome and Joan asked me to speak about the 1950s inside the 20th century. This is, of course, a difficult exercise because this decade is very complex and also contradictory. We also speak about seven case studies, but we have to insert them into the context of European and also global history. So to begin with, I would say that the 1950s hold a special place in the history of the 20th century. Placed right in the middle of the century, this formative decade played a pivotal role in the transition from World War II to a new, long-lasting world order. Internationally, the 50s brought about the beginning of the Cold War, characterized by the escalation of the ideological and military conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States, marked by the Korean War, the arms race, the increasing intensity of military weapons, also the space race and the launch of Sputnik 1. And the tension between the two superpowers mounted to such an extent that the end of the 1950s and the beginning of the 60s were to be the tensest years of the Cold War, which culminated in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And by and large, we could say that although the Soviet Union was successfully contained, communism made nevertheless significant territorial advances because it took advantage of the process of decolonization in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. So the decade led to the greatest worldwide expansion of the communist system to about a quarter of the world under Soviet influence at the time. Domestically, however, the legacy of the 50s is rated starkly differently in the East and in the West. In the US and generally in Western Europe, the 50s are seen as a period of stability, progress, and growth, leading to a fairer and more equal society. In the East, the 1950s are remembered as the heydays of the process of Stalinization, characterized by hard repression and state-sponsored social change. And so the memory of the two decades is markedly different. There's a powerful nostalgia after the 1950s in the West, while in the East, the 50s are almost unanimously presented as the dark or obsessive decade. Yeah, in the United States, of course, this was the generation of the Depression, so these were the unlucky children of the Depression, but they were the lucky teenagers of the 1950s. Whereas in the East is really the dark decade of the 50s. These differences notwithstanding, there is, however, a common point in the global evaluation of the 50s. There is a consensus in East and West alike that the 50s were a formative period of transition, paving the way to a new society after the traumatic European Civil War that ranged from 1914 to 1945. This transition led to the rise of capitalist welfare state and the affluent society in the Euro-Atlantic world and the building of real existing socialist regimes in Eastern Europe. So in this presentation, I aim at integrating the sweeping demographic and socio-political changes of the 50s into a larger synchronic and diachronic historical perspective, by judging these changes against the background of the World War II and its aftermath on the one hand, and the outcome in late socialism on the other. And I would like to pay attention to forms of political mobilization from below as well as from above, and to the position and reaction of various social strata to the state-sponsored campaign of social change. And generally, of course, we do have to address the issue of periodization. I think that contemporary historians use a rigid periodization, approaching post-1945 period as a distinct historical era. And of course, there are good reasons for that, but I think in a certain way, this rigid demarcation obscures the numerous continuities and even the past dependencies from the war period to post-war period. And I follow here Jan Gross's work, who showed that post-war developments and the process of Sovietization cannot be understood without taking into account wartime developments, such as the gradual departures from democracy, the building of dictatorial regimes, a regime of economic centralization and autarky during the war, ethnic cleansing through deportation and genocide. In fact, we know very well from 1938 to 1948, about 40 million people were killed or relocated from Central and Eastern Europe. So massive demographic change, which also means a social change through the elimination of the Jews, part of the middle class, processes of depopulation, of deportation or forced relocation. So I argue that in Central and Eastern Europe, the 1950s were characterized by two distinct but interrelated processes. The destruction of the old bourgeois democratic society on the one hand, and the building of a new socialist society on the other. In the first instance, the socialist state behaved like a totalitarian spoiler state. The state was young, but it was not yet an almighty state. Yet it was learning fast how to identify, neutralize, and destroy any opposition to the regime. On the other hand, the socialist state embarked on a process of social engineering to build a new society. And so these two dimensions work hand in hand. As Stephen Kotkin pointed out, communism did not just destroy the old society, but they built a new one, indeed a civilization, a distinct world with its own rules, material reality, design, taboos, and way of life. So building and destruction worked hand in hand. The new was not articulated in a vacuum, but in a struggle with the old, which had to be appropriated, obliterated, hidden from the public eyes, or simply exterminated. And so I want to see this challenge that we all historians face to account for repression, but also for transformation in daily life, and to account for the coercive side of the totalitarian state, but also forms of consensus building and mobilization from below. And we could start with the question of chronology and periodization, and I go along with the periodization that the organizers propose, the afterwar. Stalin arbitrary from 49 to 53, then the interregnum from 53 after Stalin's death to 56, and then the end of the decade. Of course, this is more political history. I think if we deal with economy, we would have to have a different periodization, social transformation, a different one. For example, collectivization started in late 40s, sometimes finished in some countries even in the early 60s. And there's also this idea how we integrate the 50s within the 20th century. And I think Jerome and Joanna proposed this comparison between the 1980s. I think there is an intriguing comparison here with the 1990s, because the 1950s were indeed the years of socialist transformation. I go along here with the Kenneth Jovit concept of breakthrough. It was the years of the breakthrough to socialist transformation. And so it's such an important transition period. The 1990s were the opposite, undoing the communist transformation, sometimes by going back to a statu quo ante. Political parties were recreated as in the 1940s. Property was restituted as in the 1940s, so undoing the 50s. And so if we have the revolution in 1950s, I think we have a different type of revolution in the 1990s. Revolution as a movement of rotation, going back to the statu quo ante, just like in the original astronomic connotation of the word revolution. And so what this challenge does to historians, I want to review briefly the main stages in the evolution of Stalinism. And so we started in the 50s and 60s in the Western Europe with this totalitarian model. This was mainly dominated by political scientists. They focused on ideology and the political system, which they characterized as totalitarian, and they emphasized issues of repression, terror, and coercion. So this was the key through which to understand the socialist states in the 50s. And so we have a first developmental model of totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt, because it looks at the origins of totalitarianism. And so the features would be total domination of every sphere of life. The essence of the new regime is terror. The main executioner is the secret police and not the army. And the concentration camps are the laboratory of the regime experiment in total domination. Hannah Arendt, however, was very prudent when she used the word totalitarianism. For Soviet Union, she only referred from the period 1953 to 17 to 29, and mostly 1929 to 41, so collectivization, industrialization, and then immediately after the war, a second period of re-Stalinization. And she was hesitant about Eastern Europe. Was it totalitarian in the late 40s, beginning of 50s? She was not sure about it, at the writing, of course, at the beginning of 50s. Yeah, but her view is still important with this idea that totalitarianism is a domestic experiment and constantly transforming reality into fiction. So the role of ideology, so its main goal was to destroy the essence of man, and totalitarianism has discovered a means of dominating and terrorizing human beings from within. Now, another model which actually became the received wisdom of the Cold War is Friedrich and Brzezinski. And they say about totalitarianism as being an autocracy based on modern technology and mass legitimization. They actually look at Soviet Union from 1917 to the time of their writing as being totalitarian, and also Eastern Europe. And of course, you are familiar with the six features of the totalitarian model: unofficial ideology, single mass party, monopoly of the means of armed combat, monopoly of all means of mass communication, a system of terroristic police control, and a centrally directed economy. I would not disagree with these features. I think they characterize a centralized totalitarian regime. I think the problem with this model is what they don't say. This view of society really only speaks about victims and victimizers. There is no society in between. There is no pluralism. Well, we know that socialist society were complex societies. Another issue is that it's very static. It doesn't speak about how a totalitarian state is being built. It would be a mistake for us to think that Eastern European state socialist regimes were almighty in 1950s. In fact, we see how they build their coercion capacity through, for example, collectivization. At the beginning of the collectivization, they had no control over rural areas. There was terra incognita for them. It was through collectivization that they conquered the countryside. So the state is being built here. And it was never almighty, of course. That's an ideal type. It was more of a spoiler state, destroying opposition, but not almighty in terms of full capacities. And so from here, we have this idea of unitotalitarianism, fascism, Nazism, and Bolshevism. What happened afterwards, of course, is the social turn with the revisionists. They say, well, let's bring society back in. We have to look at revolution from below as from above. We should look at interest groups, and we should take an institutional pluralist model. So there was a certain logic for terror under Stalinism. It's not irrational. So there's social support for terror, social history. So terror as social history. And here it's more treating socialism as a modernizing ideology, dictatorship, and as a normal society. There's this issue of normality under socialism, and also renouncing actually the word totalitarianism. It's not by chance that Sheila Fitzpatrick, for example, more recently published this book, co-edited this book, which is Beyond Totalitarianism. And its aim is to go well beyond the now outdated 20th century model of totalitarianism, ideology, and personality. And then there is the third wave, and I think I would place this conference also in this third wave, the cultural turn of the 90s and 80s. This time we have cultural historians, anthropologists. They focus on political language, discourses, practices, and political rituals. They want to bring back ideology, which was actually forgotten by social historians. And they criticize these social historian revisionists for their tendency to de-ideologize the working of the Soviet system, explaining its durability in terms of the interest of those groups in society that were identified as beneficiaries. And so you have Chela Fitzpatrick and Stephen Kotkin. Yeah, I'm very fond of Kotkin's book, Magnetic Mountain. And he speaks about Stalinism as a civilization, not in terms of superior civilization, superior world, but in terms of being a self-contained world with its own reality, rules, worldview. And so to illustrate this dual nature of the 50s, destruction and building a new world, I wanted to focus on depeasantization. And here I also want to touch upon this idea of comparison, because it's key to what we do also, so for this conference and for the exhibition itself. So we run into problems of mental maps and symbolic geography. We speak about Central Europe, Eastern Europe. Obviously, this is a part of Central Europe, these six states that were incorporated forcefully into the Soviet sphere of influence. So we speak about Soviet Eastern Europe. We can speak about East Central Europe, but I would guess we should include here the Baltic states as well into this concept. And so if we look at collectivization, for example, this shows the issue of periodization. Certainly we should start with agrarian reforms in the late 40s after World War II. We should look at the nationalization of industry and then the collectivization, that when it begins 48 and finishes in the late 50s or early 60s in various countries. So this is an exercise in comparative history. And we could speak about a process that starts in 1929 in Soviet Union, finishes by 1965 in Albania. There are 21 intensive years, but with two breaks, 35 to 45, and then 53 to 56. And so we can have a diachronic comparison and look at this period's three waves, USSR, the Baltic states, and the territories annexed by Soviet Union during World War II, and then Central Europe after the war, 45 to 65. And then we can also have a synchronic comparison, these case studies among themselves in the last wave, 48 to 56. But here, I think we should also take into account similar campaigns in China, Southeast Asia, Cuba, and various African countries. So in fact, we should look at Central Europe, but from a more global perspective. And so what's the aim of comparison? We can create typologies. And so we came up with our work on collectivization with models of the collectivization, be it the Stalinist model, neo-Stalinist, the Hungarian model, a model in itself, or abandoned collectivization in Poland and Yugoslavia. And this discussion should be, of course, extended to the realities of socialist agriculture. And there are types of collectivization and then systems of socialist agriculture. And Nigel Swain showed that they are quite different from each other. So it's a single model, but then you have so many versions, quite different from each other. So you have pluralism. And it is through comparison that we can build such typologies. But I think there's a need here to go beyond comparison, because these case studies were not isolated. They are actually in a complex interaction with each other. And there is new work on Sovietization showing that it's not a one-way street from Soviet Union to Eastern Europe. First of all, the Soviets didn't have a blueprint of Sovietization. It was the elites of this country in Central and Eastern Europe who had to understand what the Soviet model is, and then to enact it in their own country. And then there are many intermediaries, for example, Soviet advisors, hundreds and hundreds of Soviet advisors in these countries. They were the intermediaries of Sovietization. So we need shared, entangled history, histoire croisée, and the history of transfers. And yeah, the role of Soviet experts, multilateral learning process among socialist countries, what the Soviets learned from Central and Eastern Europe. And we know in several cases they did learn for example, from Soviet Hungarian agriculture. Even Perestroika was, in fact, also, you know, and Gorbachev spent time in socialist Hungary. So there are many interactions at various levels. And then, you know, just to complicate the discussion, again, at a global level, this is a socialist system along collectivization. It's really, it's a global discussion. And even more, if we want to take a longer term perspective, we should speak about rural population and labor forces in agriculture in developing countries. And so is this is part of the global de-peasantization. And so it is said that by year 2000, the whole world became urban, predominantly urban. And that is because, of course, because China became predominantly urban. So, and the real question here is, did the socialist regime really manage to destroy the peasantry? Or the peasantry survived the communist regime? I would say they did survive the communist regime. The other question is, will they survive the new system of capitalist transformation? And that's, of course, an open question. And so I take examples from Romania to show these two aspects of the 50s, repression and destruction, but also the creation of the new man. And so, yeah, we start with the Constitution of 1948, which was amended in 1952. I take this as an example of proletariat populism, because there's a concept of populism. It's people-centrism, and it's also anti-elitism against the old elites. And this Manichaean worldview, good versus bad. And so the people is the alliance of the working class and the working peasants. The moral foundation of the new world, though, is work, which is the duty of all citizens. And the sovereignty of the people did not include all, but all the country's inhabitants, but only the working people. So of a system against exploitation. And so, yeah, this is the alliance of the working class, of the peasantry and the workers. And then we have a process of elimination of enemies through securitization, so working people against exploiters and fascist enemies. So there was a category of unwanted citizens, antisocial elements, aristocrats, landowners, kulaks, priests, unemployed individuals. And so you have a campaign of a demonization of undesirable capitalists through a series of laws that deny them property, rights, and even attempted their physical elimination. And so if we look at the process of collectivization, for example, in Romania from 59 to 62, yeah, basically you have the same periodization as in other countries. You have a stagnation after Stalin's death in 53, but then collectivization is resumed after the defeat of the Hungarian Revolution. And then the social policy in the countryside was that the party relies on poor peasants, forges an alliance with the middle peasants, but fights against the kyaburs or the kulaks, who together with landowners are about 7% of the country, and they had to be eliminated. The problem was that kulaks were social models, and Gheorghe Gheorghiu-Dej shows that the kulak is an element who is not very much different from the rest of the population if you look at their clothes, at the fact that they work. And so in the eyes of the peasant, the kulaks are worthy fellows, good, hardworking family men. So it was very difficult to actually to discover, demascate, and eliminate the kulaks. And so I looked at this campaign of dehumanizing the kulaks. I have this example from 1951. This is a first Romanian movie about collectivization. And this is a staggering dialogue. A kulak comes to a collective farm meeting, and then, why did you come? I came as a human, as a person. And so the answer is, human, are you a human? These are not people, they have no heart. We know this kind of people in Romania is a kind of race. We have we worked hard on their land. How come that you still tolerate them among us? So dehumanizing them as a step toward physical elimination. And so you have the caricatures showing them as deformed. It's really also following the anti-Jewish campaign in the 40s. And then I am struck by this caricature. So at the beginning, the kulaks are giants because they still are present in the countryside, but then they become smaller and smaller because they are about to be eliminated. And unlike in Soviet Union, they are not physically exterminated. They are allowed to join the collective farms later on. And the discourse against kulaks simply disappears, and you see how they become smaller until, you know, they disappear from propaganda. And so it's also interesting that this campaign of eliminating the kulaks goes hand in hand with the creation of the new man and also hero models, just as the Stakhanovites and the shock workers, and we saw yesterday all these movies. And I looked at the decree of the Romanian Communist Party for the Stakhanovites. Of course, this was the Soviet model. It was about adopting the glorious experience of the Stakhanovite movement in the USSR. And in this decree, and also in the speeches by the leadership, you see that the promotion of Stakhanovites and the fight against enemies were closely linked. You have in the same paragraph both. Firm fight all attempts of hostile enemies of bureaucrats to want to hamper the revolutionary activity, and then to create the moral and material conditions for the development of the Stakhanovite movement. So building and destroying in the same sentence. And so this is the reward system for medals and titles for Stakhanovites. This is the Romanian nomenclature, but obviously this existed in all countries. Yeah, and I looked at the diplomas and medals that they got, of course, copied from Soviet Union. And then the reward system, incentives, free tickets, reduced places to sanatoriums, credits, educational grants. And then there were Stakhanovites in agriculture too, so it's not only in industry. I found publications about that. And Stakhanovites was about redefining heroism. Ordinary people could become a hero. It was fighting against enemies, but it was also heroism through work. So the heroization of work as a basis of socialist citizenship, not self-sacrifice per se, but discipline, perseverance, in quantitative terms, but also quality work and innovation. So, of course, they were an instrument of Sovietization, and I looked at the Romanian press, and the first Stakhanovites heroes came from Soviet Union, and they went, they were paraded in the industry and to serve us. And then the Romanian ones emerged from this Romanian Soviet unit, SOVROM. And then you have a generalization of this system. And you could say that Stakhanovism was an avenue of individual social mobility, but also an avenue of collective social mobility, because it was for big brigades or for factories to actually be collective actors of Stakhanovism. They are also role models and agents of change. They are agents of economic growth. They wanted to be also agents of technological innovation. There were these meetings between shock workers and scientists to benefit from the insights of the organization of production. And then from the Soviet model, you see autochthonization of the Stakhanovites. Then I found references in the press that a Romanian hero, female hero, it's also the gender aspect, the liberation of women, Romanian machines, so Romanian technology. So you get Romanian heroes with Romanian technology as Stakhanovism going native. Yeah, and so the major issue is here stigma and charisma. If we think about the 50s inside the 20th century, so through these forms of mobilization, the party created new identities, new social identities. This is how the working class was created. And there's a tradition that was perpetuated. We saw yesterday in the movies. This is a picture from 2017 in Romania. An electrician who said, it's the last time that they excavated from this mine, the closing on the mine. And so this is a way of life comes to an end. And also workers speaking about Stakhanovists and say, I was raised by my grandfather who was the most decorated Stakhanovite. And so he takes the tradition from his parents. And this is in 2018. So this tradition was perpetuated. So I call this stigma and charisma. Charisma, of course, coming from this idea of heroization. They have the call. They are the special ones, the ones that they are agents of transformation. But in post-communism, that's a kind of stigmatic identity. They are collaborators. They are the ones that benefited from the regime. So in a way, the stigmatics of yesterday are the hero of today, those who resisted the communist regime, whereas the heroes of yesterday, are they the pariah of today or are they marginalized? I mean, I find this gap between stigma and charisma when I go to villages and I speak to people. They're kind of proud of their achievements, collective farm, and so, but they know that that's not value nowadays, and it's it has been destructed, it has been obliterated after 1989 immediately. So it seems to me that there is a tension between past heroization and contemporary stigmatization. And so this leads me to the last issue with which I want to finish, the memory of the 50s nowadays. Because I think this is an important issue, the perception of the 50s, and it should be treated in the exhibition. So I spoke about the contradictory nature of the 50s. Repression, but also consensus building and identity building in a socialist way. And so we have two traditions of studying communism. Communism as a lived experience, the history of everyday life, and then communism as a totalitarian repressive regime. You know these two movies, Goodbye Lenin and The Life of Others. I think they illustrate very well these approaches. But you find this in the museums of communism. You have memorials, museums of terror, entertainment parks, documentary center, but I think there's a cleavage between museums of terror, which focus mostly on the 50s, and there's museums of everyday life, mostly on the 60s and 70s. And so I'm fascinated by this museum in Eisenhüttenstadt. It's a museum of everyday life. It's actually the first one in Eastern Europe. They put together objects of daily life in this still town. So the architecture, it's an open-air museum plus the Museum of Everyday Life. They musealize the 50s, but not as terror, but as everyday life. Yeah, so this is the Dokumentationszentrum Alltagskultur that they are. And then the DDR Museum in Berlin, it's a private enterprise, but also commercializing nostalgia, speaking about everyday life under communism, Trabant, you know, all the objects. So museums of daily life really focus on objects. Museum of terror mostly on abstract concepts. And so, you know, position to this is the House of Terror. Well, there are many museums of terror. The House of Terror in Hungary, I think, is the most representative. This is, in fact, in my reading, is not a history museum. There are no real objects there. It's a museum of a concept, the concept of unitotalitarianism, the comparison between fascism and communism. And mostly the idea of terror. You see the word terror there, which is actually reflected on the building and on the paveway. Yeah, and you see actually the definition of totalitarianism by Friedrich and Brzezinski is follows through systematically from the justice system to deportation economy. Yeah, and there is something about daily life, but it's only about 60s. So the museum is in black and white. That's the 50s. In the 60s, you have a little bit of colors, but pale color. Affluent society is a copy from the West. And you have the Sziget Museum in Romania, in the prison, former prison. Yeah, and the Romanian Gulag, again, the terror of the 1950s. Yeah. And then you have entertainment parks. Again, socialist realism here in Gurtas Park is in a Luna Park. You have a zoo, you have cafes, and then you have these statues and the statue park in Budapest. So it seems to me that even 30 years after the fall of communism, we still have this schism, this dichotomy in interpreting the communist regime. On the one hand, communism as totalitarianism. On the other hand, communism as a lived experience in daily life. And I think it's a task for social scientists to bring these two together. And how can we do that? I think interdisciplinary approaches, you know, combining political science with anthropology, with historical research, with art history, But I think it's also a question of political consensus. I see this research on communism also as an effort of insociated reconciliation. And I thought that the first wave of condemning communism from a civil liberal perspective was closer to reconciliation. I see today a second way of condemning communism as a totalitarian, more from a conservative nationalist position. So it seems to me that in a way we go back to the McCarthyism of the 50s. And it's kind of witch hunt, which for me is strange because that was in the 1990s was not there, but 30 years after the fall of communism, it's with us. Thank you.
Thank you for this presentation about the kind of historical perspective, of the perspective political, which encloses political and social and also visual aspects. And I think that your idea of trying to combine different fields of research is very, very important here. And just let me start with a very small comment. I think that these two papers, they really kind of were put in a dialogue while Gabor was discussing a case study within the 50s. You showed us the whole panorama of the problem of the periodization of the 1950s. And I'm not sure if it was a coincidence, but when you mentioned the concept that the 1950s should be compared or juxtaposed with the 1990s, for the reason that it was a kind of undoing the effects of the 1950s, it's a funny thing that you mentioned that the reconstruction of the 1957 exhibition took place in the 1997. Yeah. So in a sense, even on this level of reconstructing the visual kind of space of the 50s, it is interesting that there was this urge in the 1990s during the period of transformation to kind of see it in another light. That is just one of the comments kind of summarizing your ideas.